Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the newest episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined by my two partners in crime. There is Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, welcome to this latest episode.
And Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Welcome to this episode, which is being recorded in the place beyond the pines.
I thought you were going to say, like, stunning high-definition 3D surround sound.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. As Nick has just tipped, today we will have our feature review, which is The Place Beyond the Pines, the newest film by director Derek Cianfrance. I think that's what we landed on, right, as far as how to pronounce that name?
Yeah, or Cianfrance.
Cianfrance. And starring Ryan Gosling, Bradley Cooper, Ava Mendez, and Dane DeHaan. Before we get into our review, though, we will be having a brief discussion regarding the passing of Roger Ebert to reflect on the way that he influenced us as film critics and perhaps as people as well. Before we get into any of that, though, we should say that you should look for us on iTunes, subscribe to us. That way you'll be getting not only these episodes, these little feature reviews, but also the coming onslaught of recorded interviews. Currently up, by the way, this past week was an interview with Shane Carruth, the director of Primer and Upstream Color. So find that. And we'll also be having a interview with Brady Corbet, correct? Is that how you pronounce it? It's going to be one of those days
Yeah. For
the pronunciations. Brady Corbet of Simon Killer, which also came out this week. If you ever have need to talk to us, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And actually, on that note, we got an email over the week
that
I wanted to point out because, I don't know, it's kind of ironically funny. In room 237, which you reviewed last week, a man claimed that the only things that could be spelt using the letters R-O-O-M and then N was either room or moon, and that this somehow proved that Kubrick was confessing to faking the moon landing. However, an astute listener pointed out that that could also spell moron. So make of that what you will.
The mystery grows.
It grows. Maybe that was Kubrick calling everyone who didn't get that a moron. Huh? Huh?
Yeah, no, it's
possible.
Good.
Anyway, so that was fun, and thank you for writing in, and we always appreciate stuff like that, especially because we have a sick, sick, depraved sense of humor. And yeah, that's about it. So, let's talk about something a little bit light on the levity. This week we lost one of the luminaries of modern film criticism, Roger Ebert, who had struggled for years with cancer and unfortunately succumbed. So we wanted to take some time to reflect on what the man meant to us and just kind of what we've lost with his passing. So, Nick, why don't you start us off?
I was, you know, it's funny how this happened. I was actually in a film class when Roger Ebert had passed, and we were watching a film, which I'll actually talk about a bit later. And when the movie ended, my professor was looking at her phone, and she said, "Oh, I hate to," because the film we watched was kind of dark, and she said, "I hate to bring more of a cast more of a pall over the class, but you know, Roger Ebert has died." And that was, I never heard a hush sort of go over a class like that, the way the air was just sort of sucked out of the room. And I thought it was just really interesting how, I apologize if I'm conflating like I'm Lisa and Margaret or something, but, I find it interesting how I was in a cinema studies class as I heard that news, because I got to thinking how, I think like a lot of people, when they heard of his passing, I sort of got to thinking about how he's affected my life, maybe in ways I didn't even fully appreciate or understand until now. But I was thinking to myself, you know, I might not even have been in that class if it wasn't for him. I don't know if I would have had the same interest in film. And I don't know if I would have been at all confident to discuss my opinion of film from a young age if it wasn't for his show, which, unlike some listeners, you know, because I'm younger, I didn't see it until the final years, and it wasn't even with Gene Siskel. It was with that other dude. And
Roper?
Yeah, I mean, I know his name, but I this is, I want to pay respect to Roger Ebert, not acknowledge Richard Roper. Sorry.
Jesus. All right.
Anyway. Yeah. So it was, you know, I mean, it was just very sad in a way I wasn't expecting, because I sort of have this thing, which I don't know if this is cynical or wrongheaded, but when somebody who is of an older age, who's had a lot of accomplishments, dies, I'm not really sad, because I think to myself, you know, they lived a long life and they accomplished a lot and so on and so forth. So we don't really need to mourn their death so much as to celebrate their legacy, which thankfully is true of Roger Ebert, and thankfully we've been doing. But regardless, I don't know. The death hit me more than I was expecting, in ways I was not expecting. And it's been nice to see this outpouring of love and supports, which I feel like, I mean, someone on Twitter pointed out that there are very few people you can think of who would get that sort of unanimous reaction as he has. And I think that's a testament.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is weird how I don't think I saw a single negative thing at all. Like, it's a terrible affliction of our modern condition that whenever someone dies, there's always going to be someone who's happy about it. But not the case with Roger Ebert. And I was actually really glad to see that, because I was expecting some asshole who liked a movie that he didn't like to just come out railing against him. I don't know why. Like, again, it's just one of those things. I guess we've been inured to the thought of people celebrating someone's death, which is, now that I think about it, not really saying much about us as people, but let's try to move beyond that for now. It's going to be one of those things where we all tell the story of how we found out. Yeah, I had been at work the day before, and I saw a tweet that had said that he had relapsed and was, you know, taking, I think, what he called a leave of presence. And so I knew that something had gone wrong, but I thought that, you know, I don't think expected that he would then slip away so quickly. The following day, the day of his death, I was actually insanely ill. I went to work, and I had a fever and chills, and I just, like, I got home at around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, passed out, fully clothed in my bed, under the covers, and when I woke up from startling fever dreams, I checked Twitter just long enough to find out that Roger Ebert was dead. I then tossed my phone away and went back to the fever dreams for a while. So it was probably the most symbolism-laden way that I could have found out about it. And it was weird, because I couldn't really absorb it all at once like other people did. Like, it was remote, because I was too busy thinking about how I felt like I was submerged in an ice bath and I was, like, gonna go completely insane. But Roger Ebert was a huge influence on me, because when I was a kid, before I convinced all my other friends that movies could be more than just dinosaurs eating people off of toilets, he was, like, all I had. So whenever, and I couldn't talk to my parents either, because I think I've made it clear on this podcast, my parents are not deep-thinking film people yet. I'm working on them. But I would go on the internet, and I would, to kill time, read old reviews of his. And it started off with whatever movie I had just seen, and then it moved on to movies that I had seen previously, and I was interested in his opinion. And then it became kind of a game, where I would try to figure out if he was going to like a film or not like a film. And then once streaming video became a thing, I started watching old episodes of his television show for basically the same purpose. I wanted to find out what he thought of these films, and through listening to him express himself, it helped me gain a better appreciation for the things I was feeling. And you know, I write fiction, and whenever people ask me, you know, how do you become a fiction writer, the answer is always, you read a lot of people, and then you adapt their form into a form that actually suits who you are as a person. And I think that reading the reviews of Roger Ebert growing up, you know, that's basically what I did in order to become the critical thinker regarding film that I am today. So, yeah, it's weird. It's like the remote kind of familial mentor that, you know, I never met, but who always was kind of out there, you know, lurking around. He's like the only critic that I would read every review he wrote. Like, I'd see that he wrote a review for a movie I was completely uninterested in, and I'd still read it. And the idea that he's gone is, I don't know. It's still a little hard to grasp. Because he wasn't exactly a public figure. He wasn't out there walking the red carpets. You know, like, there'd be a notable absence of Tom Cruise in the world. But, I think Roger Ebert's more impactful, but still more nebulous, just because for most of us, he was just words on a page. And it's not going to be until we've gone long enough without those words appearing that it's really going to sink in, I think. But, Danny, what about yourself? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, like Nick, I was also in class when I heard, and I sort of kind of just took off, like, at the next break we had. And then I kind of just went to the library and started reading a lot of like obits and tweets that had already gone up. And then I was talking to Jordan, and he wondered if I would write a piece for the site, and I did that. And I think it probably speaks to Ebert's influence that if I were to kind of write that piece again, I probably wouldn't need to repeat a sentence. You'd just have so much more to say, because just of how much he accomplished and how far his influence spread. And I think one of the main things for me, as kind of all of us as being film writers, is not only the quality of his writing, but how much in his later years he championed kind of younger critics and up-and-coming film writers, because it just, I don't even know if he knew how much it meant for someone like him to put a review on his blog or on his site for a writer that no one's heard of. It's kind of incredible. It would be like Michael Jordan running a camp with a high schooler and telling everyone that this high schooler is like good enough to teach you all or something like that. It's just kind of amazing. And more personally, I grew up in Chicago. So when I started getting into movies, he was kind of a regular topic of conversation in my house. And I remember, because we would get the Tribune, and the critic there is Michael Phillips. And, I remember whenever Michael Phillips would kind of give a movie a mixed review and my parents would be wondering if they should see it, I would kind of use Ebert's review to convince them, because most of the time, he would have given the movie a more positive review, and I would kind of be able to rope them into taking me to the movie. And so I kind of used him for selfish reasons there, but I think he would have approved. And yeah, so that was kind of my experience. Obviously, we're not even a week removed from it yet, so it's definitely more to sit on and think about. But it is a blow to the field, but he has so much that he left behind as well.
Yeah, it's a good point, because he had like an entire series that was just highlighting people, like film critics from around the world. I think he called it his far-flung correspondence.
Yeah.
And then, and I know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, one thing that I picked up on his obits was the auditioning process for his At the Movies series when it got revived with Ignaty Vishnevetsky and Christy Lemire. Mm-hmm. And I was picking up on a lot of people who had auditioned for it. And I think one of them was Wesley Morris, who, like, I believe he's won a Pulitzer Prize for film criticism. And I mean, for Ebert to like not pick him, I don't know what the logistics were or anything. And this goes for a few other people too, I'm guessing, but it just says something about how much he wanted to kind of go after people that weren't as recognized yet.
Yeah.
I thought that was pretty incredible.
Well, one of the great things about him was, I mean, I was reading him the other day, and I was reading some of my old reviews like from a month ago. And I was like, you know, I write much more cerebrally than him, and it wasn't a knock against him so much, it was almost a knock against myself, because he had this great way of kind of, I don't know what the proper way to say it is, you know, he sounded like a regular guy who was just insanely enthusiastic about films, and his reviews were so accessible because they would put across complex ideas just as straight, normal conversational tone, which is something that I have never been able to do. And it actually kind of made me feel like I had to continue to grow as a critic in order to become just as nonchalantly good at it as he is. I mean, it's weird. Like, mine are much more essay-like, much more academic, whereas his were so, like, accessible and populist, and he really was, like, writing for everyone. There was no pretension about him. And considering the immense amount of weight that he had in the critical world, I mean, that's insane. Oh, man. So we have any other final thoughts to throw on? Set this adrift.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like most of what's, I don't know if most of what's been said or could be said has been said, but yeah, I feel like the ground has been covered just because a lot of people seem to have had, it's like what Danny said, is that he could have rewritten his thing completely and, you know, never had repeated himself. And I feel like a lot of people have this weird thing where they all sort of have the same experience or impact with him, but then there's these unique things that go, that apply almost directly to them in a way. Mm-hmm. Which is the mark of someone who truly left an impact, I would say.
Well stated. So I think that'll bring us to the end. If anyone has some memories of Roger Ebert that they'd like to share with us, to share with the world, send them to us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. But until that point, let us talk about the feature film today that we will be reviewing, The Place Beyond the Pines by director Derek Cianfrance, starring Ryan Gosling, Ava Mendez, Bradley Cooper, Ben Mendelsohn, and Dane DeHaan.
Ladies and gentlemen, introducing Luke and the Heartthrob.
Romina here?
Who's that guy?
He's yours.
You're not gonna tell me?
I heard from you every year. Just took off.
My son and I should be around him. I wasn't around my dad. Look the way I turned out.
How are you going to take care of us?
I can't think of another line of work that I'd rather be in.
You're so smart. You can do anything you want. Just don't understand why you're doing this.
I'm a cop, Chad. Got a kid? You want to provide for that kid? You got to do that using your skill set. And your skill set? Shit to hell.
The Place Beyond the Pines is a sprawling epic story that begins with Ryan Gosling's kind of daredevil motocross rider, Luke, trying to start a new life to provide for his infant son, who he recently discovered that he has, which sends him on a path which will draw him into the orbit of a cop played by Bradley Cooper, cop's name is Avery Cross, and then will ripple outward for years to come. So yeah, that's a decent way of putting it. We'll talk about the plot more when we get into spoilers, but for now, let's talk about what we thought about this movie in general. What was it trying to accomplish, and how successful was it? So, Nick, why don't you kick us off? What'd you think of this film?
I really liked it. And I was going into it perhaps a little, I don't want to say skeptical, but I was unsure of what to expect because of reactions that had come out of Toronto all the way back in early September, if you can even remember back that far. The same festival that premiered The Master and Cloud Atlas for an idea. It's been a while since I've been hearing about this movie. And I came out of it pretty much, you know, not at all disappointed. My expectations were not necessarily exceeded either. I found that the movie was sort of kind of, it's a movie that feels very aware of itself. It's a movie that feels very wise in the way it uses its actors and sort of your expectations of them to build tension and build drama. And it's also, to that point, an interesting growth for, you know, Derek Cianfrance's prior film, Blue Valentine, which, have we all seen that?
Or? I have not, actually. I need to get on that, because I really want
yeah.
to.
Okay. Yeah, I saw that film.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it is an interesting evolution for him because it is a story of a much larger scale, and it's dealing with these different topics and sort of the overlap that the two films share. I feel like this is an improvement on that, even though I was generally a fan of Blue Valentine. And not only that, but it is a pretty it is satisfying as a crime film, I found. I think that it works as the story of multiple generations and cops and robbers and the women in between them, which not between them, I guess behind them, because it's not really like a love triangle going on here. But anyway.
And then you refuse to share her.
Yes, that's right. It's exactly. This is just like Someone in Love. But no, not really. Anyway, so yeah, I definitely liked it, even though I do think that it's pretty good when it could be great, and the fact that it's not great is slightly unfortunate, but I will take what it is. I will certainly take what it is.
All right, and Danny, what about yourself?
Yes, I am similarly positive on the film. I found that even hearing from people that, you know, like what you've seen in the trailer isn't what the story is going to be, even with that in the back of my head, I was still just really surprised with where this movie went narratively. And that was kind of just a really fun experience because it's not too common these days, especially with a movie with actors like this where you've been hearing about them for months and you've seen footage. I feel like it's rare to watch a film and like this and not know where it's going. And I felt like that during this film in a good way. And we can talk more about that in spoilers. But I do think it's a flawed movie. And I think maybe the one reason is that it kind of has.
It's not flawless?
It's not flawless.
Oh, okay.
But where I think the problem is, I think kind of like the thematic point of the movie can be summed up in a sentence, maybe. And I feel like it just goes to these really epic lengths to hammer it home rather than maybe trying to expand its ideas. But at the same time, whenever I like think I want to criticize this movie, I feel like I just have to respect it because it's like this guy just went out and made this insane epic movie about fathers and sons, and it's really personal. And it doesn't feel, you know, you could make the argument that Ryan Gosling, you know, dressing up like this and acting like this is a bit superficial, but even that feels very personal for some reason. Like, this director knows that setting and he knows, like Nick said, how to work with actors. So even when the movie, when I felt like it was maybe taking on more than it can handle, it did have a kind of sincerity to it that won me over.
Yeah, I'd heard divisive things about this film, I guess. I hadn't heard anything specific because, as I've said before, I attempt to avoid the hell out of all spoilers and even reviews and discussions of films that I haven't seen because I don't want to be sullied. And so I had no idea what I was getting in for. And it was a movie that, I don't know. It took its time, and it helped me get into a kind of grudging understanding of all the characters involved. And the way that it modulated its plot movements and the turns that it took and the progression of the story, I think was interesting. And I enjoyed it. I guess I should start out by saying that I'm positive on this movie. There's something about the scope of it, though, about the kind of intimate epicness of it that just is a little, it's weird but in a good way. And I think that all the actors equip themselves well, and I think that the direction, I don't know, I mean, like, it's not particularly from a visual sense, it's not particularly inspired, but for the story at hand, it does do good. And I think that primarily the work done with the actors is where the direction shines through. It's weird because I don't have anything negative to say about the film specifically. Like, there's no actor that stood out as being someone that I just like thought was doing a terrible job. I didn't think there was any ineptitude in the editing. The music was sometimes a little on the nose, not in a great way. And yet, I'm not I'm not 100% glowingly positive. I think it's a very good film. I think it's a solid film, and it's a film that I would recommend to people. But maybe it's just the fact that I'm coming off of seeing what are probably going to be two of my favorite films of the year previously this week, and then seeing this, where this just felt a little obvious, a little straightforward. Mm. It was a little, it was, despite its length and its breadth of the story, it was just a crime thriller.
Mm.
But one that did take a deeper view of crime in general. So I know that sounds like I'm negative, but I swear to God I'm not. Because this is a 2.5 hour movie that does not feel 2.5 hours. So, yeah.
Yeah. So a few things. I think, did you mention the word, like, boring at one point?
Did I? Because I think I just said it wasn't.
Not boring. In a way that you thought it was boring, but I think you just said it. Maybe not.
I wish we had automatic playback because I don't think I did. But
are you reading his mind?
No. All right. But anyway, one of the things I kept thinking to myself during this movie was that it was a little bit boring, but in like an interesting way.
I can understand and, that thought.
Yeah, that's why it made me like think of that because I saw it with it was a pretty like packed crowd and like. When that happens, you can kind of get a sense of how people are feeling about the film. And I feel like people were surprised by how slow it was. I wasn't really surprised, but I could feel that people were. And so the movie had this weird tension to me where it was like, it was very interesting because it took its time so much. I think that's the phrase you might have used. It took its time.
Yeah.
Another point you made was the direction of the film. And that was one of the areas where the movie kind of fell off for me because it opens up with this really sensational tracking shot of Ryan Gosling walking through this carnival. And, you know, you see his back and he's kind of putting his clothes on and he's smoking. And then it ends with these three guys riding their motorcycles inside this metal globe. And it was one of those, it's one of these like really great openings because you've just never seen a profession like that before. I've never seen three people ride a motorcycle like that in my mm-hmm. life. So that was great.
What about in the Simpsons movie?
Oh, it's a blind spot.
I do know what you mean though. Cause that. The thing is, and here's the thing, when I saw that opening, I appreciated it, because it's all done in one take,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I'm assuming that at some point, you know, they just swap out Ryan Gosling with another guy, but like, they don't really use that kind of effect anywhere else in the film.
Well, that's a little bit of why the movie fell off for me aesthetically, because I feel like in the opening sequences, there's a lot of pretty stunning craft, not only in that shot, but also in these sequences where Ryan Gosling starts robbing banks.
Yeah. No, those are some really great scenes.
Yeah.
And was anybody bothered by his voice when he robbed a bank?
It's very high pitched.
Yeah.
Everybody get down on the fucking ground.
Yeah, he was wimpy.
Yeah, like I don't know how he does it. I just tried to do it, and I think I can't speak anymore. Like, yeah, he sounds like a kid crying in a grocery store. But I kind of got into that because, like, just from like, I guess that's, I don't know if that's what his voice sounds like or if that was a character choice. But I mean, the character is a very soft spoken kind of guy, and so I feel like he doesn't have the deep rumbling baritone necessary for that, and it kind of made those scenes oddly comic in a way that I think was absolutely purposeful. So I mean,
yeah,
just, if we're gonna bring that up, because I knew that at some point we'd have to bring it up, because I remember Nick giving us his impression of Ryan Gosling in the trailer for Gangster Squad. And I figured that would come up again.
That's right.
But yeah. Danny, you were saying?
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah. I think I said most of it, but it was just the general impression I got that the opening of the film was very effective viscerally, and I feel like it got less and less so as the film went on. And I've heard the argument made that, you know, that's that's intentional, because the more you get into this story, the more you just want to focus on the characters and the emotions, which is fine. But, I mean, it's clear that this director has the ability to do things like that, so I would have just liked to see him maybe experiment more throughout.
And, Nick, what about yourself? Did you feel anything regarding the visual aesthetic of this film?
It is funny how the movie doesn't really stick to what it had established in that opening shot, because the opening, sort of with its almost cliched indie handheld shaky cam, is actually elevated above that by the setting, which actually made me think of a Dardenne Brothers movie in a way.
Yeah.
And, you know, if Dardenne Brothers movies could use anything, it's more motorcycles. So, I mean, I know Les Promis has one, but not
you,
like a Daredevil.
You know that kid from The Kid with the Bike is going to get a motorcycle when he grows
up. That's true, yeah. the man with a hog. No, but anyway.
Jesus.
That is true, and I do think that the most exciting moments in the movie do, I think, intentionally so come in the first half. Particularly, I mean, I hate to sort of bring it to this one element, but it is with Ryan Gosling's bike, which it's very fascinating the way he uses that as a tool of excitement with the audience, because he very sort of jarringly cuts into his escapes from the bank, it seems like, or rather his when he's in the middle of his escapes, and there's the sound of that roaring sort of disgusting sounding dirt bike, and it's moving very fast. Like you definitely have a sense of motion there, which is speaks to C.N. France's visual skill. And also, you know, I mean, there's also a great chase scene with the cops when Bradley Cooper shows up.
Yes.
And after that, the movie does go into a different register, but I liked that other register. I would enjoy seeing an entire movie with that Ryan Gosling character, but the first like 45 minutes or so we got, I thought was quite good. And I'm willing to trade that for what else we got. Even if it's not quite as satisfactory, it is still of quality.
Yeah, I guess I can get behind that. I mean, I understand the necessity for changing the tone once the focus shifts a little bit. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, first of all, like, but it's so weird how wimpy that damn bike sounds. Like, it literally sounds like just a really bad lawnmower. Mm. And so it was always weird to see, like, you know, this epic escape with just that, like, ridiculous. And again, I think that goes along with Ryan Gosling's high register squeals as he's telling people what to do. But yeah, as the movie leaves the stunning escape set pieces behind, it's not even that it changes register so much as, like, there's no new thing to fill in where that had been. They removed those set pieces without really putting anything in. And I think that's just my problem. Like, if they had substituted in some new kind of interest, it would have been more interesting, you know? But they don't. They just kind of leave it hanging out there. But yeah, we're all pretty positive on this film. I think we all say that you should go and check it out, correct?
Mm. Yeah. Can I, before we go into spoilers, I just want to say something about the music in this movie, which is a very interesting choice. There is sort of a choir element to it, I guess you would call it. And I've heard some people criticize it, saying that it's too ethereal, it doesn't really fit the grittiness that the movie's going for. But as I was watching the movie, and I don't know if this was just me trying to sort of excuse some of the flaws that it has later on, because I was enjoying it, but I came to realize I think The Place Beyond the Pines is actually sort of a fairy tale. And it might sound weird, I know, but there's something about the presence of that music, which is, it's very difficult not to notice. And the way the film sort of coalesces in its third act in oh-so-convenient ways, where it turns out that there are apparently 17 people in the town of Schenectady. But I was thinking to myself, too, well, I don't know. There's sort of a confluence of these two elements, the choir music that has this heavenly eminence to it, and this element of the story, which in a realistic situation would be pretty ridiculous. It'd make for sort of a great 60 Minutes profile, you know, back in 1997. So, you know, you'd have Morally Safer on 60 Minutes going, you're not going to believe this story, kids. That's not really how Morally Safer talks, but anyway.
Okay.
But I do think that there is a reason for that, and that can be justified. And I, even though it is my own explanation, and admittedly an explanation nobody else has given, which means it's probably wrong, I do like it nevertheless. I think that it is something C.N. Ferenc had in mind. And it does, you know, conveniently, it does sort of explain away a flaw, or at least a couple. So that's just my way of looking at it.
All right. Well, when we get into spoilers, you're gonna have to explain to us how this is a fairy tale.
Okay.
Okay. And speaking of which, why don't we get into spoilers?
So absolutely.
Spoilers. Yeah. Hooray. Spoilers for The Place Beyond the Pines. So one of the craziest things about this film is, and someone getting up from the audience that I was in, so earlier we were talking about the audience. I'm just gonna get this out of my system real quick. I was very unaware of 90% of the theater I was in, and that was great. Like, I was invested in the movie, they were all invested in the movie. Behind me, however, was an old couple, and the woman sitting with the man had so many fucking questions. And being an elderly couple, I mean, you know, God bless the old. They've been through so much. We're all going to be there someday. But being
they've
old,
been through so much.
I mean,
like World War II and
70
and,
years of just
the Kennedy
being,
assassination and
70 years of just being alive like that. That you've earned the right to some shit. But she was so loud.
Reaganomics.
I mean, technically, I was born when Reaganomics was going.
Yeah, but they were.
First Gulf War. No one remembers that one. Anyway, you know, it's just like she would be like, you know, all right, we're in spoilers now. Sure, let's just go for it. Like when Bradley Cooper wakes up in the hospital, she just would turn to her husband and be like, "Who's that?" And her husband would be like, "That's the cop that just shot Ryan Gosling." Oh, did he get shot? Yeah, I think he got shot in the knee. Like, what the fuck? Shut up. Like, this was endemic throughout the entire film. And it was just like, what are you supposed to do in a situation like that? Like, it's impossible. There's no good way out of it.
Call the police.
If only. But yeah, so now that I've used that ridiculous story.
I shush old people.
I kept turning back and giving them the death eyes, and they would look at me. And then they'd be like, okay, well, we'll stop this conversation. But the next time there's a scene change, I'm going to need some filler. And you're going to have to tell me what's up.
Like, I mean, if you can take comfort in anything, know that they'll probably be dead soon.
Jesus.
Oh, my.
So,
considering that we just spoke so lovingly about a man who died this week, I feel like that's a joke made in poor taste.
Yeah, but they haven't done anything with their lives, so it's fine.
I don't know that. They had a French couple sitting next to them they seemed to be friends with. Anyway.
Wow.
unnecessary. But yeah, so it was just like I said, the entire goddamn film. And this is a problem that I've had in independent theaters. Like, it seems like people think that as long as they're talking about the movie, that it is perfectly fine to continue talking. I went to a film festival in Annapolis. I was watching a documentary about jazz, and people, I guess, in the audience knew about some of the stuff that was happening. So every time that, like, the documentary would be, like, building up to something, like, you know, in 1912, a 17-year-old girl from East Harlem walked into this club, and the person behind me would be like, oh, yeah, they're talking about Billie Holiday. And then it would just be like, Billie Holiday. And then I'd just turn around and be like, I'm trying to watch this fucking documentary. Shut up. I'm not here to listen to you give me this information. Oh my god. Anyway.
Did you like the doc?
The doc was great, yeah. It's called Oxygen for the Ears, Living Jazz. It's about the jazz scene in Washington, D.C. Oh, fuck. But yeah, so that's my random rant against people who talk in independent theaters, which is a completely different beast than the rant I gave about people who talk in normal theaters. Have we come to a point in our civilization where we can't shut up for 2 hours? Like, is that... I don't know. But yeah, so Place Beyond the Pines. Let's get back to that. So the movie takes a startling turn, especially if you've been only paying attention to the marketing, when Bradley Cooper actually confronts Ryan Gosling's character, because he basically, like a hound dog chasing a raccoon, he gets him to a high elevation where he's stuck, and from that point on, the raccoon has no choice. And Ryan Gosling gets shot in the chest and falls out of a second-story window, not before he's able to get off a shot and hit Bradley Cooper in the knee. And then Ryan Gosling is dead. And you're just like, okay, damn, that happened. Then the film follows Bradley Cooper as he becomes aware of some interdepartmental malfeasance in the police force and attempts to do the right thing, and yet somehow parlays it into advancing himself politically. And then 15 years later, we meet both of their children, who then go through another thing. So one of the people who stood up in my theater said, after the movie was over and you were allowed to talk, wow, it's like we got a triple feature for the price of one. And I agree. I agree 100%. There were so many points where I was just thinking, like, was it completely necessary to have all the other stuff before? Or could each of these segments of the film be viewed independently without the segments that came before it to give them context? And would it still be as effective? And I think it's not until you really get to the third one that you realize that, no, you couldn't have that. Because having that information about those characters and seeing what their lives were like instead of just what people are envisioning them to be post whatever great impact they had was actually a very interesting choice. And it's rare that we get a film that seems to be so cut and dry, you know, cop shoots bad guy, cop struggles with morality of choice, fathers or sons reaping the sins of their fathers, that actually spends that much time with these people to really give you an idea of the kind of men that we're dealing with. So I liked that. That was good. I appreciated it. Does anyone else think that the length and the depth of the plot was necessary? Does anyone have a problem with it?
You know, you say that they couldn't function on their own, and I mean, the first part could definitely.
Oh no, I mean they totally could. I'm saying that, given the contextualization of all three together, it gives them a depth that otherwise might not have been there.
Right, and I guess I just feel like, you know, they certainly don't need to, because I was a fan of the way they come together, even if, yes, as many have said, the third act is problematic in the way it kind of separates itself. It sort of divorces itself from what has come before, while still being tethered in a manner that's not entirely comfortable. I don't know. I have to take this film as a whole, and even if there is a bit of a jump there and a bit of adjusting, there's also sort of the funny thing about how I saw this with Jordan, and when we were walking out, I mentioned the film The Good Shepherd from 2006, and how in that movie, Matt Damon works for the CIA for 20 years. He's a very stressful job, and he does not age a single day. This sort of suffers from that, because Bradley Cooper, they really make no effort to age him in this. He looks exactly the same.
They just give him a little bit more of a manly haircut.
Yeah.
And his son looks like he's 30. Or at least to me. He looked like he had a few kids and was like he had a job or something.
His son did look surprisingly old. I think it's this is going to sound weird. I think it's his thickness.
Just the way he talked, he was like perfect, but he did look very much older than Dane DeHaan.
He's got the build of a 27-year-old, like a real douchebag 27-year-old.
Douchebag 27-year-olds have a specific cult.
Yeah, he looks like he belonged on Jersey Shore. It's great that Dane DeHaan calls him out on that.
Yeah. So anyway, where was I even?
They didn't age people.
I mean, it is a nitpick, yes, but you know, you have Eva Mendes, a very beautiful woman who Derek St. Francis is wise to sort of, you know, he doesn't like give her a lot of makeup or anything. She sort of fits. I don't want to sound like Jeff Wells here, but she does fit that. If you know what I'm talking about, I'm not going to acknowledge it otherwise. But she fits that sort of that place, and then you jump 15 years, and oh, she looks precisely the same.
Actually, no, I don't agree with that. I think that she's one of the only people, and maybe it's just because when we see her, it's usually in moments of tumultuous distress. But when they age 15 years, I think that she actually does age a bit.
Okay, I mean,
she seemed to have graying roots. She seemed to be a lot less ethereally beautiful. Like it was, she still was, but it's that kind of declining beauty. God,
right.
That's a terrible thing to say.
Yeah,
but it did seem like this life had taken its toll on her, and this fucking kid had taken his toll on her because he did not seem like he was a joy to be around.
Yeah, and we can complain and nitpick that, but I do feel as if ultimately it's a small thing, but it does speak to the problem that faces this movie when it has to, not has to, but when it decides to make that jump.
I see. Yeah, I can get behind that, because like I said, you know, Bradley Cooper, I think when the movie starts, he is 25, I think, and yeah, I guess so. Like 15 years later, he's something like 40. And
you can, the funny thing is that you can buy him as a 40-year-old, but the fact that he's 25, come on.
Like I said, they just kind of give him like a youngish man's haircut, like, and then they put him.
And he's got a windbreaker.
Yeah, the slightly ill-fitting windbreaker. And the,
you know, he's kind of, you know, he wants to do well, but he's not really dressed to impress.
Right. And then they age him up. They give him a better haircut and a suit, and then a 30-year-old for his son. What did we think about? Because I feel like Bradley Cooper and Ryan Gosling do very good work in this film. I think that their scenes together are the easiest, or not together. They only have one scene together, and it lasts about a second before they brutally attack one another. But their scenes, taken as a whole, are pretty they're standard, they're good. Like, you expect from these two guys what you got from them, and I think that while their work here is laudable, it's not as interesting as stuff they've done in the past. Though for Cooper, this and Silver Linings Playbook will hopefully wash the taste away of fucking The Hangover 2 or some shit like that. But what about the kids? Because we've already kind of spent a little bit of time talking about, you know, Long Island Johnny, or whatever the hell his name is, Avery's son, AJ. So let's talk about Dane DeHaan as well. Like, what were your... This is the most problematic story because it depends on a lot of coincidence and a lot of crap that happens. And I don't know how well it comes off. Okay, Danny.
All right, yeah. Well, I actually kind of liked both kids. I agree that the last section... it's the most vulnerable to nitpicks because it is so focused on coincidence and whatnot. But I think Dane DeHaan is a pretty interesting presence. I don't know if you saw Chronicle last year. It's like a movie about a group of high schoolers turning into superheroes or whatever. But he kind of has this really like serious, almost scary presence when he gets in a dramatic situation. Like, he just looks like he's about to explode sometimes, and I thought he was pretty good. And then the other kid, I actually don't know his name, Emery Cohen, he's 23.
Oh Jesus.
Yeah, that's insane. They make him look older than he is.
Yeah.
All right,
Jesus,
whatever.
Christ.
So they don't really do much to Bradley Cooper, but they make his son look older.
Maybe they accidentally aged him up when they were supposed to age up Bradley Cooper. And they're like, well, we only have 3 days left to shoot, so let's just go for it.
Let's just go for it. But him, I thought, I don't know if he gave as well-rounded a performance, but he definitely fit the character perfectly. His first scene in this new school, he just walks. He's just like kind of walking around the lunchroom, and he has like a unzipped sweatshirt and like a undershirt underneath. He just looks like he just got out of bed.
He got
and he
that
like
douchebag chain.
Yeah. On. Then he sits down by Dane DeHaan, and he's like, "Yo, man, like you get high." And it was like a really funny scene.
And the funny, like, yeah. I mean, it's always sucks for me when a character, like an actor plays a character I know I'm going to hate. Because like I want to be like, yeah, he's a really good actor, but he's good at being a guy that I detest.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate because he really is great in this film. But God, did I want to punch him in his goddamn face every time he spoke. And I've known guys like him, and they are awful, and they do deserve everything that's coming to them.
Yeah, entirely, I feel like maybe his first few scenes, he was like, you could see him as pretty vulnerable just because of the way they set up, like, Bradley Cooper, like, having divorced his wife and then not really wanting him.
Yeah.
But once it gets into the idea of, like, he's throwing that party and he, like, demands that Dane DeHaan get him, like, pills.
Yeah.
Just, like, stuff like that. He totally, turns to the bad side.
Yeah, what a dick.
Yeah, right. In those scenes, I was like, "You are just a dick, man! Like, leave this kid alone."
Yeah, didn't your district attorney father just yell at you after he got you out of like a possible 15-year sentence not to talk to that kid?
Clearly disobeying.
Nick, what about yourself? Like, what did you think of these two actors and their storyline in general?
Okay, so. When I saw the film, I didn't know too much about the direction it goes in. I had some idea, but what I had heard sounded so interesting that I consciously decided to avoid what was out there. And when when the Emery Cohen character AJ, son of Bradley Cooper, moves to Schenectady, he's in the lunchroom, he's looking around, and then he kind of sits down. You see the back of a kid's head. And I was thinking to myself, no, 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 don't do it, don't do it, no, no. And then sure enough, who was it but Dane DeHaan?
Yes.
And, you know, I had that reaction because I was thinking to myself, okay, this is the direction it's going, okay, fine. But then after that, I sort of had to settle for it because I was enjoying the film enough to the point where I wanted to keep going with that. And, it is a problem because it is, again, so reliant upon coincidence, but I do think that because the movie is a fable more than a traditional, strict, straight down the line narrative, it can function and it's okay, ultimately. And I also feel like the performances between the two kids are, I shouldn't call him a kid because Dane DeHaan is 26 or so, which is really strange because he looks like he's about 14.
Yeah, he looks so much younger than the guy who's 3 years younger than him.
Yeah. But, so I did like their interplay, and when I came back in, I heard Danny talk about how the kid AJ just turns into a total dick, and I do think that there is sort of a perhaps a little too obvious, but maybe enjoyably so, crossover between the two generations, sort of the Venn diagram of seediness or something, if you can draw that up in your head. And if it's obvious, I do think that C.N. France is aware of that, and he's sort of comfortable with playing things to a degree that feel familiar and clear. And that he does it well is what ultimately matters.
All right. I guess that... part of that is, like, for all the problems, I mean, the convenience of the story and the weird choice of making a 23-year-old look like he's 30. It executes itself well. I think it's just the uncertainty of where the movie is going and, like I said, the convenience that makes it a little weird to stomach at first. But I think that it does deliver well on the promise, I guess, of what happened those long years ago. I am, however, not sure that I understand or appreciate like the final scene of the film where Dane DeHaan goes and buys a motorcycle and decides to go west.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty obvious. You don't think so?
What do you mean it's pretty obvious?
I think it's pretty obvious what is... sort of what's being intended there, right?
Possibly. I mean, like, because all I could see was, okay, this kid has been lied to about his father. He finds out his father was a robber. He wants to kill the guy who killed his dad. And then he's just like, all right, I guess I'm going to run away now because the guy said he was sorry. And now I'm just going to live my life wild and free and be like my dad. Like, what did you get out of it, Nick?
I do think that the movie sort of establishes it establishes one of its main connections to the past with the fact that his son rides a bike. Anybody? I say it like that because I thought it was a little funny how, oh, look at that, he's riding a bicycle, just like
yeah.
his father.
Yeah, when he's escaping from stealing the oxys.
Yeah, exactly. And,
but I mean, like, he's not going to continue a life of unmitigated criminal mastery.
Oh, no, exactly. I mean, that's why I think it's a little obvious, though, because he's riding a bike, but he's going in a different direction.
Oh.
Ah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, so... It is part of, again, that sort of self-conscious on the nose nature to it, which I could sort of appreciate because because it works, it functions, it moves along. That's all I really care about ultimately. I'm not so concerned with if I'm going to, you know, be reading people who are criticizing it for that because I feel like the movie is, again, aware. It is aware of that.
Okay. Quick related comment about Dane DeHaan's character. One of the things I liked about the film and how it treated this idea of fathers and sons was that Dane DeHaan never really learns about Luke through his own family, like Eva Mendes and her husband are both really tight-lipped about him, and he can't really get them to say anything. So I like the idea that he has to, like, meet these strangers like Ben Mendelsohn and get them to tell him about his dad, and then that the only way he can kind of feel satisfied with that is to, like, buy a motorcycle and just ride off by himself. So it's just this idea that, like, your heritage can kind of catch up with you in, like, really sort of weird, unexpected ways. Like one of my favorite scenes in the film is Dane DeHaan's scene with Ben Mendelsohn for that reason, because, like, he is learning all these things about his dad from a total stranger who seems like a bum. Like, he just has beer and he lives in the forest and whatever.
That sounds awesome. What are you talking about?
But it was, like, a really moving scene, I thought. And I thought that was one of the film's more interesting ideas.
I think that it's weird that Ben Mendelsohn's character picks up Ryan Gosling's character, offers him a place to live and a job, and then once Ryan Gosling dies, he apparently keeps the trailer as, like, a shrine to this guy. To the point where 15 years later...
Which is much weirder when you say it than when it plays out in the film. Yeah. Because I do think it was funny how he still had it, but now that you put it that way, it's...
Well, way to ruin it.
I mean, it's not like anyone else has lived there. The fucking sunglasses are still there. Like,
yeah.
Anyway.
Which is weird because the relationship with the two of them wasn't really, from what we could tell, was not a deep or meaningful one.
Right, no, it wasn't.
Yeah, so.
And it ended with the Mendelsohn having a gun put in his mouth. Like, anyway, unimportant. So yeah, I think we've aired our grievances and talked our way through this. So... that is our thoughts on The Place Beyond the Pines, a worthy film, if ever there was one.
We should mention Bruce Greenwood.
Bruce Greenwood, who shows up in the Bruce Greenwood role, which from here on out will be the man who talks to the morally ambivalent hero as he lays in a hospital bed, recovering from his heroic moment, and then tells him, you got to get your story straight.
Yeah.
Should have brought back the southern accent.
Yeah, and the mustache.
Yeah.
He's so good in both films.
He's just so good at being that. If I wake up in a hospital, I'm going to be like, get me Bruce Greenwood. I need Bruce Greenwood to tell me what happened to me.
What if he just, like, mentioned Whip Whitaker in Place Beyond the Pines? Like, Bradley Cooper was like, all right, here, I have this evidence. Like, these cops are corrupt. And he just accidentally starts talking about flight.
You know, the thing
let me
is,
let me tell you about a guy I knew once who thought he'd do the right thing. He ended up in prison.
No, you know what's funny is that scene takes place in 1997, so it's entirely possible that his character moved to the South, developed an accent to try and fit in. And oh man, if these two movies take place in the same universe, I swear to God, I won't lose it.
I think that we could totally make them take place in the same and we could also probably say that this film takes place in the same universe as Killing Them Softly.
Yeah,
with probably. Ben Mendelsohn's shitty character moving to New Orleans and becoming more oily somehow.
Just totally, totally devastated. Someone like breaks into the trailer and steals like his relics, so he just has to leave.
Oh my god. Okay. Anyway, let's move on and bust through our recommendations for next week real quick. So coming to Blu-ray and DVD on the 9th, Naked Lunch Blu-ray for Criterion Collection, Gate of Hell Blu-ray for Criterion Collection, Richard III Blu-ray for Criterion Collection. So that's all pretty awesome. Major Dundee, double feature of, I can't read what it is, so I'm not going to say it. It doesn't look good anyway. We also have Hyde Park on Hudson. Did anyone see Hyde Park on Hudson? No?
No. That looked a little bland.
Yeah. to be honest, truth be told, I was looking forward to it for a while until the reviews came in because... I mean, there are a number of reasons. One is that Bill Murray as FDR is such a fascinating idea.
Right? It's so weird.
Second is that, you know, I love the history that movie, you know, sort of deals with. And also, I was born about 6 minutes or so from FDR's house. Mm-hmm. And I go there, like, quite often, actually, because it's a really fascinating, beautiful place. So... The movie had some things going on, and then the reviews came out. So I was just thinking, wow.
I kind of wanted to see it first because Roger Mitchell directed it.
Oh, wow. He pulls you in?
He has Changing Lanes, The Mother, Enduring Love.
Like, yeah, those I are watched movies. Changing Lanes recently. And that was good, pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, like he's an interesting director for like these small personal dramas. Like Enduring Love and The Mother are fantastic films. Changing Lanes is fantastic. Notting Hill. And Venus is supposedly very good. I've never seen it. But, you know, Morning Glory and Hyde Park on Hudson, I don't know what the fuck is happening. Like,
oh, I saw Morning Glory.
Was that good, Danny? It's okay. You don't have to answer.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Okay. other than that, I mean, it seems like all the Fast and the Furious movies came out. The Sorcerer and the White Snake, I've never heard of. That's about it, really. So, yeah, any opinions on any of these? Anything worth checking out?
Naked Lunch.
Yeah, probably the Criterions here. Yeah, Criterion.
Well, I'm not sure how... I don't know if I want to see that movie in high definition, necessarily.
Yeah, I don't know. Naked Lunch, it's a good film. I own the original Criterion version, just the DVD, but I don't know if I need it in high definition.
Mm-hmm. High D. Yeah, I don't know if I feel like... could it get more disgusting? Maybe, with this Blu-ray.
Yeah. I will, however, say that even if you've never watched any of the other Fast movies, you should check out Fast 5, because it is... goddamn ridiculous. I'm being 100% serious. Like, this is on HBO all the time, so you don't even have to buy it. Just like flip onto one of the 12 HBOs and it's probably playing.
Gonna get ready for Fast and Furious 6.
Gonna be awesome. My only concern is that they're gonna be doing things on purpose now that they did on accident previously. You know, it's gonna be one of those things. But yeah, Fast 5 is outstandingly hilarious. Like, for The Rock's beard alone, you should see this film. Make of that what you will. Anyway, coming to theaters on April 12th, we have 42, the life story, is it the life story or just, I don't know, a biopic of Jackie Robinson, directed by Brian Hegland. Scary Movie 5, which seems just awful. Scary Movie 5, which you may also know as A Haunted House, which came out earlier. We have To the Wonder, the latest film by Terrence Malick, featuring Ben Affleck, Olga Kurylenko, and Javier Bardem and Rachel McAdams. We also have The Angels Share, the newest film by Ken Loach, who previously directed Kes and The Winds That Shakes the Barley, Disconnect, which I've never heard of, and that is it. So,
oh, Disconnect. I kind of want to see that.
All right, so Danny kind of wants to see Disconnect. I am actually excited for 42 and To the Wonder and Angels Share. Nick, what about yourself?
You know, the thing about 42, which I don't believe anybody has ever said, is that, I mean, I literally do not think anybody's ever said, you know, the thing about 42. But anyway, the trailer is very good, but it's written and directed by Brian Helgeland, who sucks. So,
I'm not a fan of Brian Helgeland.
No, he's awful.
What about, he wrote LA Confidential, didn't he?
He co-wrote a screenplay based on an acclaimed book, yes. 16 years ago, yes, that's correct.
Okay. You didn't like A Knight's Tale?
I've seen some of it, and I'm not, no.
Oh, he did write Tony Scott's Pelham movie. Because yeah. That movie's all about the script.
And Green Zone and Robin Hood and Salt, right? And The Vampire's Assistant.
He didn't write Salt, did he? I thought Kurt Wimmer wrote Salt.
Co-writer.
Oh, all right, well, whatever. Anyway.
That's what it says. So, okay. So yeah, the trailer is good, but I am concerned about Brian Helgeland, and also I just feel like, you know, do we not know that story already?
I don't know. Do people? I don't know what they're teaching in school anymore.
It's a good story that people should know, but I feel as if
also I don't know if you know this, but baseball season just started, so I feel like and this is right. About the Brooklyn Dodgers. Like, that's the team he was on, right? Yeah, Brooklyn Dodgers. I mean, like, that's the quintessential American baseball tragedy. There's a lot of history there. I don't know. I feel like if you're into
it... Is it tragedy?
They fucking moved, man!
Oh, right. I didn't know what you meant.
Oh,
I was going to say, I don't know. If you see the story of Jackie Robinson as a tragedy, I'm curious what angle you're coming from.
No, I mean that's a storied team that had great impacts on this country and its history, and they moved. They moved, right. Like... Fucking thieves in the nights. It's like it's the worst thing to happen up until the point where the Colts left Baltimore. Anyway.
Okay. So anyway, yeah, and you know, Harrison Ford is Branch Rickey looks pretty fun, something different. Oh, but I'm taking way too long. 42, I don't know. I'll wait to see how the reviews are, but I'm sure I'll be waiting until home video.
Okay.
And then there's To the Wonder, which we're gonna have a lot to say about.
Yeah, that's what we're gonna be talking about next week. We've all seen it already.
Yeah.
I'm saying you should go check it out.
The new film from Terrence Malick, yes?
Yes. Congratulations, Danny. And so yeah, we'll couch our discussions until then, but I say check out To the Wonder. And then Angel's Share, which looks good. I'm a fan of whiskey and Ken Loach. So yeah. All right.
Fair enough.
Let's talk about the things that we've watched on our own, and then we can get on with the rest of our lives. Danny, why don't you start us off? What's something you watched that you think we should check out?
Oh, well, I'm sure the both of you are familiar with a film called M.
Yes.
What?
Directed by Fritz Lang. Yes?
Yes. I said yes. Okay. Now already, like, three times.
Great, great film.
Yes, it is.
So I watched that, and then... The Museum of Modern Art was showing a print of Joseph Losey's 1951 remake. And so I caught that. And I think it's a pretty rare film. And not many people have seen it. And I liked it a lot. It brings the action to Los Angeles. And it's funny to see how the interpretations of a killer's psychology both stayed the same and changed a little bit. There's a lot of like Freudian elements, and then there's a sequence with Rorschach tests, which aren't in the original. And then there's also a scene where on the TV where there's like an ad for five things you don't do with your kids, and it's like, oh, don't let them accept the lollipop from a stranger, and it's like four or five more things like that. So it was a good movie, and you know, hopefully, I don't know, more people will see it. It's pretty good.
All right.
Yeah, the poster actually advertises M as the most gripping motion picture you've ever seen.
Oh,
So if it's advertised, I trust it's true.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my opening line, but I forgot it because it is like the first thing you think of. Like, this is.
If there's one thing that Mad Men has taught me, it's that all advertisements must be correct.
Yes, coming back tonight.
Yeah, it is. I'm excited. That's right.
As am I.
Excited. All right. So Nick, what about yourself? What did you watch?
So I had mentioned earlier the film I actually was watching in classes as Roger Ebert passed away. Which, unfortunately, I think that's sort of what I'll kind of always sort of think of the movie as, in a way, because that's just sort of a kind of a big association, obviously. But the movie is Miklos Janko's The Red and the White, which is a war drama from 1967. You know, the thing is that we had sort of come to a period of 60s Hungarian cinema in my class, and this is the film that my teacher elected to show in full. And it kind of blew me away. I had never heard of it before. I'd heard of Janko, but not this particular picture. And most of the movie is consists of long takes that last upward of 7 minutes, I would say. And a lot of the movie is a war film. And it's not a war movie in the sense that Saving Private Ryan is one where there's some action and there's, you know, the layoff period with discussing. It's pretty much all battles for 110 minutes or so.
Jesus.
And it's quite intense, as you can imagine, especially because of the way it's composed. And there is sort of the movie doesn't really have a quote-unquote plot, per se. It's more of these moment-by-moment pieces that create that sort of build to this crescendo that create this very powerful impact. And it's a hugely nihilistic, very sad film, but it is an absolutely beautiful one and an amazing, amazing achievement. Thankfully, you can actually watch this on Amazon Instant Video. You can rent it for $3. And, I mean, you know, what else are you going to do with that $3? You're going to rent some silly romantic comedy or something? Come on.
Yeah. So, come on, Philistines. Exactly. Jesus. Yeah.
So The Red and the White, really fantastic film that I would give the thumbs up.
The Nick Newman seal of approval?
Yes.
Give it 2 Newmans? Anyway.
You don't want to know what Newmans are.
Is it a rusty venture? No one watches the Venture Brothers, do they?
No.
Never mind. So I'm gonna talk about a film.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, it's a new film to me. It's a classic Roman Polanski film from 1999. It's called Ninth Gate. Has anyone seen this film?
I've seen it. All right.
Okay, I'm recommending.
I'm glad you're here just to confirm that that movie actually exists and I didn't just dream it up.
Right. I remember advertisements for this film and being interested in it, and so when it was on. Again, I think it was probably HBO or Showtime or something. I was like, I'm going to fucking watch that. That's awesome. Like, Roman Polanski, Johnny Depp, Frank Langella. Like, you good people. What is this movie? Like, I'm recommending this because I need other people to see it so that they can tell me what is happening.
Yeah, the film is completely incomprehensible as a story.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on this because I know that we're wrapping up and people are like, come on, just tell us where we can find you and what you're going to be doing next week. So I'm just going to run this down real quick. This is a movie about a guy who is a rare book dealer who hates everything and everybody up to and including rare books. And he has been given the most valuable book in the world, which is a demonic text. And he's being asked by the most untrustworthy, snakiest dude on earth to verify its veracity. And so he has to go find the other 2 copies of this book to look at them to make sure that, like, they're the same. Which is, and part of me was like, you know, rare book dealing is one of those things, like, it could be interesting. This is an interesting idea. Like, this is a world I'm not used to, and I love the ability of movies to show me stuff like that. But these are rare book dealers who are constantly looking at books that are 500 years old and smoking over them and drinking over them. And just carrying them around in a sack that is on their shoulder, wrapped in a shitty piece of fabric. Like, It's incomprehensible. It is insane. And this is before we get to the floating people and the... Like,
the least erotic sex scene in film history.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Like, yeah. This movie is insane. And it's just like Johnny Depp plays the least inquisitive, most thick-skulled son of a bitch ever. Like, here's a tip to anyone who ever happens to find themselves in a situation like in this film. If you tell your shady employer, who always seems to know where to find you, that you found a different version of something, and he's like, you must get me that now. And you're like, well, the guy said he wouldn't part for it to save his life. And then he says, oh, really? And then hangs up, and then the next day that guy is fucking dead. You mm-hmm. know who killed him!
Yeah.
And I don't care if that's a spoiler, because, like, this movie is so crazy that it doesn't matter. Like, so someone go out and watch The Ninth Gate, and then let's talk about it, because I don't know what the hell happened there.
There's not a lot of logic going on here.
No, there's none at all.
And I don't really like the movie that much. It's definitely lower tier Polanski for me, but it is nevertheless absolutely fascinating. And I had seen it years ago, and I've been itching to revisit it since I've seen almost every of his films since, and I feel like it would be good to just kind of give that another spin. But God, that movie, you know, the thing about The Ninth Gate, just like the thing about 42, actually, exactly the same, is that there's a lot to dig into, but it came out at a time when sort of internet discussion of such things was not as prevalent, and also it sort of came and went, and people completely forget about the movie. They don't remember that Depp and Polanski made a movie together, even. But I feel like if it had come out today, there would just be a million articles and dissections on this film discussing it and trying to figure out just what is going on. And it's too bad that in the time since, it has not caught on the way maybe it should, regardless of its flaws.
I just think there has to be a reason that in this movie filled with rare book dealers that everyone is smoking over these rare books, right? Like, Polanski had to have had some, like, crazy idea where he's like, wouldn't it just be insane if these people were awful?
Well, I had read this just sort of shows that there's very little out there on the movie, but a lot of it's worth reading. I'd read, you know, a theory that Johnny Depp is actually the devil, and he doesn't realize it, and he's being brought back to his position.
Oh, that explains why he's stuck in a floor. Never mind. It's
and that's why he's always smoking, and sort of what the end would signify. Because the end, we haven't even talked about the ending, which is one of the strangest of any '90s movie I can think of.
Yeah,
this movie just ends in a way where nothing is explained. It's just a fade to white.
God. Anyway,
the movie is something else.
People should check this movie out. Again, just because it's bananas, and I can't believe that it exists. But yeah, that's it. That's my recommendation. If you've seen The Ninth Gate and would like to talk about it with the only other people in the world who've seen it, podcast at filmstage.com. Or you can find me online at dearfilm.net and on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan and thefilmstage.com. Nick, what about yourself?
You can find me on filmstage.com and twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And Danny?
Certainly as well on thefilmstage.com, as well as thekingbulletin.com and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
Excellent. Well, that brings us to the end, obviously. And come and join us next week when we will be talking about Terrence Malick's newest film, To the Wonder.
In a jelly-like thing, and particularly peanutty peanuts.
Hmm. So you have a bag that's filled with peanuts and almonds that are covered in a jelly-like substance?
No, it's emeralds, the nut company. It's in like a canister.
Oh, okay. I gotcha.
Yeah, I'm just going to eat it like this the entire show. Come on, roll it.
I am rolling. I'm recording this right now.